called that my graduate school because I happened to sit outside of the office of the two managing principals at the time. So I got to hear how they did their business. You know, I got to hear how they handled design problems, how they treated people. And it was a great, great, great learning experience for me.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Designed, an architecture podcast. We appreciate you listening. And once you're finished, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast, rate us, and leave a comment. Enjoy the show and have a wonderful day.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Designed with me, your host, Aaron Prinz. As always, just to start out, I want to say thank you to all of you for listening to the podcast and telling your friends about it, the reviews on the iTunes review section. It's just really great. I love hearing your feedback, so thanks a lot. Also, be sure to follow us on Instagram at designed.podcast for everything we have coming up so you don't miss anything. We have great interviews coming with architects from Mosier Softy's office. We have Ginny Wu. It's just a lot of things coming up, so you don't want to miss it. And this episode is part 2 of 3 of Page Week here at the Design Podcast, where we're sitting down with 3 designers from Page to talk about the towers they have going up. This episode is Chris Walsh. She's an interior designer at the Dallas office, and she's currently working on 5 towers here in Austin, Texas. So just a lot of great insight to what's going on, some historic preservation stuff, and just a really great interview. So sit back, relax, enjoy. Here we go with Chris Walsh. Get started here. We were talking earlier that you're here in Austin from Dallas working on 5 separate towers going on throughout the city. And right. I think Austin is really, it's kind of a unique city because this boom sort of has come about in the last 15, 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. And you have all these old small town buildings, historic 6th Street, Rainey Street, and you're working on a project 200 West 6th Street here in Austin. And it's such an interesting story because there's an old post office built in 1914. So right. It's 105 years old. And you're integrating a 36-story contemporary tower into the mix. So can you kind of take our audience through what makes this building so special and kind of what were some of the challenges you saw or experienced Sure. when trying to work with a 105-year-old building?
You know, I think the first thing is really understanding the history of that building and what it meant to Austin, kind of even what it meant to the country, but just finding its place within Austin's history and then really looking at the scale of it, the style, kind of what architectural elements would maybe want to, you know, bring themselves into tower itself. And I should say we also had a challenge on the site in that There's a differential between 7th Street and 6th. And so how people came into the building and kind of worked their way up or down the lobby space and what that meant to the historic building and how that interfaced. Originally, we had looked at options where there was more of a direct connection from 6th Street to 7th. And it kind of ignored the historic building, it ignored the post office. And so that was, you know, through design, that was kind of scrapped. And we started to develop the building almost around it. So the historic building itself is a part of the lobby. We even took the colonnade from the historic building on the 6th Street side, and you'll see that in the columns that have been kind of exposed. So the lobby space itself on 6th is pushed into the building and helps with some of the scale issues of having, you know, a smaller historic building next to this tower. The other element of that is the Lavaca entry. So we have a 7th Street, a plaza area, Lavaca, and bringing people into the side of the building, but making both of those lobbies, the 6th Street, the 7th Street lobby, really work with the scale and help the historic post office be a part of that space. I'd say the other thing was just a material issue of glazing and making sure that we had in our budget kind of the extra dollars for super clear glazing so that as the glass goes basically on top of the historic building as a clear story for a part of the lobby space, but then the 6th and the plaza entry, that really the historic post office can become, is still its own and it still has like this great presence to itself.
Well, I worked on a project in Portland, Oregon. We were briefly talking about this. There was kind of a same sort of situation. There was a courthouse going around this old 1909 electrical substation, and it was being converted into high volume courts, basically. But there was this issue with the historic preservation where it's like, what do you keep? What do you mm-hmm. not keep? Mm-hmm. And so what about these old buildings really do you think adds to the architecture? Because I think it's really easy, especially this is like a common this is like a studio you'd see in school, I feel like. You have this old historic building. How do you add to it?
Right.
And I think a lot of architects, if they had their way, they'd say get rid of that old building. And they wouldn't say that in public, but they'd probably think that during the design process.
Right.
So can you take us through what those sort of decisions were?
Sure. You know, the building itself was still fairly clean and simple on the Lavaca and 6th Street sides. But then as you kind of moved around the back to the loading area, that was the piece that still had some historic elements that we needed to alter or talk about and, you know, kind of really make sure how they were treated was respectful to the building, but that also really kind of worked for what we were doing. There is an incredible, beautiful window that is on the north side of the building that is really the opening up to what will be a food hall and really a great public space. And so that was pretty easy to, you know, just help it out a little bit, but leave it alone. For this building, it's been small challenges. It wasn't like any big moves that we needed to do to make it all work together.
So real quickly, can you take our audience through sort of just your background, kind of where you grew up, what your parents did, the economics of your household, and out of all the things you could have done in life, why the heck architecture?
I ask myself that sometimes, but I'm happy for the result. So I grew up in a suburb of Chicago, one of three, and parents, my mom was a nurse and my dad a salesman. And, you know, funny enough, I think one of the things I got from my dad in particular was a love of storytelling and of sort of finding the story, even in design and in architecture. My brother was an artist, so I was kind of around that. But I was a pretty, you know, carefree, normal, middle-class American kid, but loved Chicago, loved when we would go into the city. And during high school, we moved to Texas, and so I went to school at UT, University of Texas in Austin.
The change of pace from Chicago to Texas.
It was very different, especially like for a 15-year-old, but it was great. And I kind of stumbled into design. I stumbled into design as a major. I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. And a friend of mine said, hey, you're always looking at this stuff. I was very, very fortunate. So I got my degree in interior design. I had the choice of going in a fine art route or more of an architectural background. And so I chose architecture. I know this sounds a little corny, but I had a life-changing class with Larry Speck.
He's a partner here at Page.
But a very sort of, you know, a broad survey architecture history course, and realized I loved architecture and really just the aspect of how the interior and the building, how it plays back and forth. When I got out of school, I moved to New York. I had a great experience. I started to work at Gensler in New York, and really, I called that my graduate school because I happened to sit outside of the office of the two managing principals at the time. So I got to hear how they did their business. You know, I got to hear how they handled design problems, how they treated people, and it was a great, great, great learning experience for me. From there, I transferred to LA. My husband is a writer, is in theater, and he had a work opportunity, so transferred to Los Angeles, had our first child in LA, and then realized that wasn't where we wanted to raise our family, so we came back to Texas.
As interior design, I think we're in a really interesting time here in architecture where I think there's, and I accredit it a lot to Instagram, and everyone wants a really cool photo with a backdrop. So we're moving, you know, postmodernism in the late 80s, 90s, into this like rejection of that, and now there's this resurgence in postmodernism. So can you speak to, as an interior designer, how is that impacting the work you're doing today?
You know, I think when I think of how interiors are affected today by postmodernism, other than color palettes, which is sort of just one little piece of it, I think that the kind of reintroduction of some of the symbols of architecture and of the linkage of like a work environment with your home environment and just all of that kind of melding together of different types of environments, to me, is sort of our touch on postmodernism today. It's nothing definitive. I mean, you see trends, you see materials, but really for me, the postmodern piece of recalling history in a different way or of looking at scale in those types of very traditional way, right now it links a lot to creating a more human, lived-in kind of environment, especially in the workplace.
And can you give an example of kind of what that means?
So what that means is everything from the type of lighting that's used in your environment, but probably more just the variety of spaces that, you know, you can have a more classic presented reception area, let's say, but then as soon as you get into the space and really walk into the space, you have a huge variety of types of meetings, of collaboration, of personal space, and that the environment itself, just like your home, there's different places in your home for your mood even. The same thing can happen in your work environment.
Well, you brought up collaboration, and I think it's really interesting because I think in architecture school, especially or your early years, you don't realize the amount of collaboration it takes between your landscape architect, your engineers, your other consultants, and interiors. So can you kind of speak to here at Page, and you're in the Page Dallas office, and we're right. Currently here in the Page Austin office, so there's obviously some cross-office collaboration going on. Can you just kind of speak to what that collaboration adds to the project and what Page just really does well with collaboration, I guess?
Personally, some of my favorite projects are where, as an interiors lead, I was brought in the very early stages of a building when the landscape architect was there, when the architect was there, and really looking at a project holistically. At Page, specifically, we've been doing that for a long time. You know, we've been designing inside out, outside in. But really recently, I think we've gotten kind of over the hump of location. And we've realized that our projects are better if we team the right people with the right experience level to those projects. And so I happen to be working on several projects here, but there's also people in Austin that are working on other projects. We're doing PGA headquarters, and there's an architect that's working here that's working with us on that project. And we really see that collaboration is a way to grow our staff, to really kind of help sort of form new design thinking, and to give the best product for our clients and for our projects.
Well, with growing staff, I know there's a lot of young architects that, you know, there's a concern that they don't want to be the person that knows Revit really well, because then you're going to be stuck doing Revit for 30 years. I look at it as it's kind of like a building block. Like, you need to understand how the building goes together, and how you should be able to produce everything you're asking someone else to produce, is kind of my mindset about it. But you're now a design director in the interiors. What specifically do you think you were doing? And you've also been with Page here. You started with Page in 1991, so quite a long time. But what specifically were you doing that kind of allowed you to progress through the firm? And you mentioned when you were with Gensler in New York, you were sitting outside the office of the two principals. How did that experience did that show you a certain way you're supposed to act or guide? And how do you pass that on to the next generation? It's a very loaded question. I apologize.
Yeah, you know, I think what my beginning experience showed me was really teaching by example. It might sound silly, but when we were working, you know, late at night, the senior principal in the office was seeing how we were doing, was ordering, you know, having someone else, but making sure we were fed, making sure we had safe rides home. And it really did teach me that if I was going to be a good leader, that I wanted to be in the trenches also. And so part of my job being how we grow designers, I think that we're very different in that we don't have the extreme specialists. It's like for our interiors groups, everybody kind of gets into everything, and they may have a talent that sort of makes them shine in one area, but they do learn how to do drawings, you know, how to put a set together. They learn how to at least speak that language. They learn about materials and how to research the right materials. They learn how to do tenant, you know, space plans, as well as really incredible building projects. So our philosophy of a little bit of being a jack of all trades, of knowing everything that goes into a project and being able to have a broad view, is the starting point. And that's kind of, that allows for that collaboration to happen a lot easier, because at some point you're all sort of speaking the same language and really kind of get the best out of people.
Okay, so throughout your career, you've been at fairly large firms. You've been at Page since 1991. You were at Gensler previously before that. So I think now there's a lot of, there's this boutique firm versus large firm culture in architecture, and I don't know about interior design. I'm not too versed in that.
Yeah, it's very similar.
What do you think the benefit is to having this large firm, sort of the backing behind, that the large firm has?
So I actually started working when I was in college for two women who, one was a teacher, and they had a very small firm here in Austin. I had the benefit of being their support. You know, so the advantage when you're starting out in a small firm, a small boutique firm, is you can learn a lot quickly because you're cycling through and you're helping on anything. I think that you just have to be careful where you choose to work. You know, you have to kind of realize, you know, what are your goals? Do you want to learn everything? Do you want to just specifically start out learning how to do, let's say, visualization and then finding the right fit for that? I did not, with my experience, I've never felt that I was pigeonholed into doing one thing, but I also have always been very vocal about what my goals were and what I wanted to try to achieve on projects. And we really encourage people to do that. You know, they can't expect people to sort of hand them their next level of professional advancement. They have to take ownership of that. And I think that's true whether you're in a small firm or a large one.
I'm very self-conscious when it comes to that, and I don't want to make any waves. So what is kind of the appropriate way to go about saying that?
About saying,
like, hey,
what you want to do?
Like, because, you know, I think with these things, there's a right way to do it, and there's a wrong way to do it.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm always like, I don't know what to do.
Well, I mean, it's kind of true with whether you're talking about work or just personal communication. But I think it's about sort of coming to whoever you're talking to with a suggestion for what you want to have happen and how it could happen and how it could benefit you as well as the firm. At Page, we are very active every year, not just one time during the year, but multiple times, of having very specific reviews with people about where they are in their career and how that's going and what they want to be doing. So there's that opportunity that you certainly could voice it then. But beyond that, I think it's really just feeling that I am the person who is forming my career, and I want my career to be at Page. And so to advance, this is where I'm thinking I'd like to go. And whenever I can do that, I'd like to do it. And then if you see an opportunity, reminding someone, hey, you know, I'd really like to be doing, maybe it's, you know, building science and it's more on sustainability, or it's a specific thing, you know, kind of reminding people, I'm actively involved in this outside of the office, and this is what I want to be doing. So it is tough. It's not always easy depending on the culture of where you're working, but you have got to find a way to not give ultimatums, but to really make it known that this is what I want next in my career.
We were talking about earlier that, you know, you have five towers going up here in Austin, and kind of the changes that Austin has seen in, you went to school here. There are a lot of people, I think, that, you know, they want to go down and see their friends at the Broken Spoke, and they don't want this change to come to Austin. And I think it's something that's actually applicable to every city. I'm from San Francisco, which has been, everyone knows, it's happened.
Right.
And I think a lot of these small cities, Portland, Oregon, you know, Seattle sees the same sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So what do you say to those people that kind of don't like all this growth?
Obviously, it's a tough question, because I feel that I really think, well, change is inevitable. Right? No matter what, it's never going to be the same. I know for myself, my husband and I left Austin when we graduated. We went and lived in different places. We came back 10 years later, not by plan, but it just happened to be 10 years later. And silly enough, we went to Sixth Street to go to our favorite breakfast place, and it wasn't there. And we were like, are you kidding me? It's not there. And it's just, it's inevitable that cities are going to change. I think that Austin in particular, the unfortunate part of the growth is the expense and how expensive it is. But I feel that Austin is one city that is always consciously growing. And as they look at development, if they're tearing a site down to build another development, that they are trying to get the right diversity of types of buildings and of types of people that would be there, and using that to make it something that everybody can enjoy.
Do you go through any sort of checks and balances in your head to make sure, like, that you are kind of respecting the culture of Austin, or is there anything that's taken into consideration in that regard?
Definitely. I mean, even on 200 West 6th, in that lobby is you know, the materials we used, the scale of the materials, that the floor that we're using is not a traditional, necessarily, you know, stone floor. It's a terrazzo floor, so it has a more unique, almost hand-applied look to it. It's classic, but it still is unique. And so it may seem really subtle to some people, but really trying to make the scale and the materials inviting and warm and unique, which to me is Austin. We definitely try to do that in all of the buildings that we've been doing, whether it's a, you know, grand lobby or it's a more intimate meeting space.
What's your proudest moment in architecture?
I would say my proudest moment is being in a building or being in an interior that I've done and hearing the feedback from the people that are using it. You do an ER waiting room, and you see the mom bringing her son in who's touched a cactus bush and or whatever, and you know, and you just see how the space helps guide them through, helps kind of relieve some of the anxiety, and those are proud moments. I'd say my other proud moments are when I see the designers that I'm working with kind of get to that next level and really find their own voice.
What's your biggest setback in your career, and how have you used it to forward your career to get to where you are today?
Boy, I think of two things pop in my head right away. The first setbacks are kind of the process we have to go through to win work sometimes. The RFP process is one that, you know, it's almost like a mini competition. And so you really put a lot into on your own sort of getting to know that client and coming up with sort of a plan for what their building or their interior could be. And not winning. You know, it's like, even though you're doing that, it's almost like you're in that project already. You're already thinking about it. You're already thinking about the client, and coming in second is just, it's a setback. It's painful. And so, and it's not just you, it's you along with a group of people. So you have to make sure that, you know, you kind of rally the troops and look at what we did and enjoy the time that we've done that. But those are definite disappointments and setbacks. I think the other is every once in a while we have projects for whatever reason the design is taken kind of out of our hands and decisions are made that we're not always a part of, and knowing what it could have been and then what you're seeing is, you know, kind of mediocre. Those are killer moments. Those are tough.
Well, you mentioned kind of this commissioning projects, RFP process. Kind of what sets Page apart in the interior design realm from the Ginslers, from the Perkins and Will? What makes them say, yeah, well, we're going to go with Page?
I believe part of it is that, and that's part of why I'm at Page, is I'm a design director, but I still do projects. I still do work. I'm not out selling work, having someone else do the design work. And so when we go out and we propose on a project and we meet a client and we're interviewing, that's a big part of the connection is what the people at the table are bringing to that project. And so I think that is different from firm to firm, but to be able to look in somebody's eyes and say, I'll be with you on day one, I'll be with you when the trucks have gone and you are totally moved in. I love that part of it.
Last question. What advice would you have for the young architect or young interior designer that wants to have the type of career that you've had?
My advice would be to be flexible and to realize that things aren't perfect, but that you can learn from anything, good and bad. And that I think sometimes designers that are coming in today, they're like looking for this perfect situation that will give them work-life balance and that will catapult them into design stardom. And my advice would just be to be patient and be flexible and to be willing to work hard and get off of Pinterest.
Well, Chris Walsh, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I
hope you did. Too. And absolutely.
I think the people will too.
So, okay.
Enjoy, everybody.
Thank you for listening to an episode of Designed, an architecture podcast. We'd appreciate you taking a moment to subscribe to us, rate us, and leave us a comment. Have a wonderful day.